Welcome back to another season of Remotely Speaking Up. Join me, Dr. Rochelle Haynes, and my special guests every week as we discuss how the way we work continues to change and how companies and their people can continue to thrive no matter where and how they work. For more on our podcast, be sure to follow us on Instagram at Remotely Speaking Up. Stay tuned for more. Welcome back to Remotely Speaking Up. And we are on season 4, as you know, and we have another wonderful guest with us this week. We have the amazing Erin Peters, and there's so much I can say about Erin. Hi, Erin. Say hi to our audience.
Hello. Thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here.
I'm so happy to have you. And I'll just give you a little background about Erin. Erin is a retired digital nomad. She is Canadian originally, but she moved to London after selling everything and decided that she wants to live in Europe and wants to work in the way that she wants to work. And since then, Erin, you have been blazing a trail in the area of just future work trends and just using technology to help companies leverage their businesses and leverage different ways of working. So I'm going to turn it over to you because you can tell us a little bit more about what you've been doing and what's it been like for you, that transition to the UK. And then we'll get a bit more into what you've been observing about future work trends.
Absolutely. Well, and this is where I get to kind of be a bit of a hipster when it comes to the future of work stuff, because I actually think I've been like preaching the good word for a long time about remote work. I'm actually going on 15 years working remotely, 5 of which were being a digital nomad. So I was actually traveling full time, living out of a suitcase, didn't really have a home base other than like, thank you for my sister for letting me send mail to her. And then at that point I was going, I'm kind of tired of living out of a suitcase and want to have, you know, a home base and then travel to and from it rather than the home base being literally where the Wi-Fi connects and where I unpack my suitcase for a week. So that was kind of the journey of how I ended up here. But it ties very closely with a lot of my kind of work history as well. So I had the pleasure of working with Toptal and Dela and probably, you know, 20 some odd other freelance talent platforms at this point, and being able to travel around and seeing people working remotely, internationally, you know, all these different ways of being fractional versus in-house versus contractor. You know, it was just really interesting to see how people worked. And I think this is really what fueled my passion of sharing more stories and sharing more data in this space of how the way that we work around the world is changing and how fast it's all changing.
Yeah, that's amazing. And do I have it right when I read your profile that says that you've lived in 35 plus countries?
I'm 50 plus now. So, I mean, define live, not really sure. Because, I mean, there's a whole debate on digital nomadism and visas and this. I mean, digital nomad visas didn't exist when I was doing it. It's like pre-COVID.
So, you were groundbreaking at the time. You were groundbreaking and you didn't know.
Yes. And, you know, to be honest, the Wi-Fi kind of quality everywhere at that time, too, you could definitely tell that it wasn't built for digital nomads in certain places yet.
Yeah. I'm glad that that's changed. So what do you find now in your work? Because you call yourself a futurist, and I would definitely agree with that to describe you. What are some of the most recent, because we've been through the pandemic, we've come out on the other side, everyone has tried with working remotely, and we can say have become more open to the idea, let's say. But what have you observed in your work about the future trends that are shaping the world of work?
Absolutely. And truthfully, a lot of the kind of futurists or prediction makers are all talking about some of the same themes. So I don't think that we're going to see anything massively groundbreaking when it comes to stuff like remote working, for example, or hiring more freelancers. We're simply moving further down the adoption line. So where it seemed crazy to have a whole company just built of contractors maybe 5-6 years ago, or have a whole company with zero offices, that's actually like not so uncommon now. You hear about this story more and more. And so I think as we start going further down the adoption curve, we're just going to be hearing more stories about how to do it well and how to implement it and how to basically just change the way that we're working with contractors or in a remote environment. I think the one area where it's not simply getting deeper in the adoption curve is really AI. I know we're all sick of hearing about generative AI at the moment, but this is really where we're going to see the most amount of disruption and change when it comes to the future of work. And I think this is why we're all watching it so intently.
Yeah, absolutely. And we already see a lot of consultancies that have come up as a result of that, trying to help companies adjust to generative AI. Because I think from my conversations with companies and from my conversations with senior leaders, generative AI seems to still be just interpreted as chatbots and chat GPT. And that's like the bare beginning of leveraging generative AI.
Absolutely. And I think that's the biggest thing, right? Is,
Yes.
everyone thinks about ChatGPT, and that's such a small area of all the tools that are already available to people to use just by logging into a browser. And so if we think about the fact that there's stuff like Perplexity for research, or Midjourney, or all these other things that people just, maybe they haven't even used Discord before, so let alone opening these tools there. There's just so much that people can already do, let alone the bespoke technology that's being built on these large language models. So many different platforms are using other language models for chatbots or algorithmic matching, and it's just tip of the iceberg, really.
So with adopting generative AI, what would you say to companies then? How should they go about building a culture that would allow them to leverage such future work trends?
Absolutely. Well, and let's kind of riff off of the generative AI topic as well. Is like, we need to stop looking at a lot of these things as cheating, right? You think about people who are applying for jobs or who are filling out forms and doing other stuff, and now recruiters are even going, if you're a bot, then please say bleep bloop and add a robot, so they can tell if someone's made generative AI based off of a job post and not even read it. And really, the people who are going to be innovator companies are the ones who are going, aha, how do I encourage someone to use these things to enhance their work or increase productivity and do all these other things? So people who are like, this is cheating, like the purists of human-based work, they're going to get leapfrogged over. This is a real opportunity for people who are going, I see the opportunity. I see all the things. Maybe they're not going to go 100% automated with everything in AI, which we're not there yet with the technology, anyways. But encouraging people to enhance their work or speed up their work or even just branch out even further from their skill sets, these are the companies that are really going to win. And that's the culture that you have to instill, is like, work smarter and like, go
Yes.
for it.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. And I love how you phrase it in terms of cheating, because I have heard that as well. And I've heard a lot of companies who are quite worried and apprehensive about the use of, as you said, the bots and ChatGPT, because as you rightly put it, they do kind of interpret it as cheating rather than, I like to see it as leveraging, because you're freeing up so much of your talent's time to do a lot more important things and problem solve within your company.
Absolutely. And there's a real big difference too, right? Of automation and augmentation. And I think people are going, someone's not actually doing any work at all. They're just going to automate their role, and I'm going to have, rinse and repeat content that everyone's going to have, for example. But when we're talking about augmentation, it's really what you and I are discussing, which is, how do I work, free up my time to work on important problems that need solved rather than writing a brief, right? So this is where we need to go.
Yeah, and I think it should be a relief for employees. You have a lot of companies that have, because of cost of living crisis, because of other environmental shocks, that have been forced or took the route, I should say, of shedding their workforce. So where you have employees that are left behind, who are feeling the pressure of doing three people's work instead of one, you can now take some of that pressure off employees. Or hopefully hire more people, but I mean, it does present an opportunity to reduce the pressure within the workforce.
Absolutely. I mean, it's reducing pressure in terms of, all of the amount of tasks that I need to do, but it is adding pressure in other ways. Like, we talk about what type of skills are required from that individual now. This is such a huge theme, right? Because before, I could be really good at data entry or making pivot tables, and now you don't need to do those tasks. And on the one hand, it's a lot easier because I can just ask, Copilot within Excel to do these things. But on the other, we have to think about the impact within people and teams when you take away mundane tasks, because sometimes it is just so peaceful to sit down and do some data entry where you don't have to really think super hard about what the problem is or how you can permutate that into different prompts, right? So you need to have a mix of different types of work that people are able to do. And if we take away all the stuff that is maybe peaceful or slow or repetitive, we're also kind of changing the intensity of work that people have, right? It takes a lot of brain power and emotional power to do these things still.
Totally agree. I think it also raises that debate of one, reskilling, but also whether or not, similar to what you're saying, if the intention is to replace workers with these things, because I do believe there's a place for all types of work. It does also shore up that issue of workers also having to have a continuously learning and evolving mindset so that they don't feel the pressure in terms of being replaced. I shouldn't say the pressure, I should say the threat. There's often this threat of these things will replace us. And these tasks still have to get done, but where we continue to evolve and continue to learn in the process, I don't think there will ever be a case where these things can ever fully replace human work.
Not right now, no. I think not all roles are created equally either. You know, some roles are just absolutely not at risk of being impacted by AI, but a lot of the world that we're living in, talking about remote knowledge workers, like, yeah, there's maybe a little bit more of pressure there. But one thing I think about too is, you know, we think about software developers and continuous learning and keeping up with technology has always been just such a large part of that culture as an industry, because one moment a framework is really hot, the next it's not, and suddenly you're out of work. So you're always keeping up with new ways of working. And I think that mindset and kind of joke being with being a software developer is you don't really need to know how to code, you need to know how to research things. So like you're on Stack Overflow and looking it up. This is really what the rest of the workforce is going to start doing, is I'm going to get really good at finding the right information. I'm going to get really good at writing the prompts. And this is what's going to keep me on top of my learning and on top of my skill set, is if I can develop these kind of evergreen skills. Some people might even call them soft skills when we talk about interpersonal working and all of that. But those are really the ones that are going to help you continue to grow in a more kind of frictionless fashion.
And I think this is a smooth, the perfect point to smoothly segue into this idea of creating a more competency and skills-based workforce rather than, you know, what we would have been traditionally used to, which is a job-based approach, having our work defined within specific job roles. But more and more we're hearing people advocating, myself included, to make sure that we have companies that take a more of a skills-based approach in order to preserve their competitiveness and the ability for their employees to more easily evolve.
Yeah, absolutely. And not to get like too preachy about it, but I hate jobs and roles. I just think that, like, when was the last time you applied for a job and the job description was truly accurate to what the job was? They're out of the date, or they change, or, you know, maybe someone needed one role and now we've gone through changes as a company or had new opportunities, and what happens next? So one, I think the existing job role dynamic is just fundamentally broken. You kind of force people to progress through certain stages, and that's just not how career paths work. So I'm loving this trend of skills-based hiring, which is basically going, you know, almost like the projectification or taskification of work. I have this thing that needs done, and these are the skills that I need to do them. And it doesn't matter if those skills are on this team or even in-house with me. I can hire a freelancer, I can hire a vendor or an agency, or I can bring someone over from another team who can help with this skill at this time. And one of the reasons I love it is it creates internal mobility. It allows for more choice. It allows people to play to their strengths rather than having to fit into a mold. But it also allows more freelancers and adoption of freelancers, because here's a very clear, discrete scope of work that I need your specialized skills. And now you can kind of come in a little bit more interchangeably. So I think skills-based hiring is going to help employee satisfaction, but it's also going to accelerate adoption of freelancing and contracting.
Yeah, I fully. Well, you know, I'm biased in that area already
I
because of
know.
the type of work that I do. But I'm going to take a step back just for our audiences because I think you raise a good point in terms of skills-based hiring, skills-based approach. But just for those who might not be fully clear, can you tell us the difference between what we mean by a job-based work versus skills-based work?
Absolutely. Well, job-based work really is kind of that format of employment that we're used to. I see a job description that says, this is what your role as a VP of marketing is. And you come into the job as a VP of marketing, and you're responsible for everything that was listed within your area and your function. And really, you're on one specific career trajectory and path. I would probably want to get promoted into a CMO style of a role for an as an example, and manage people who are marketing managers within. And so it is much more boxed in a particular in a traditional job and role environment. Now, skills-based hiring is different. It's okay, what are all of the skills and competencies that I have as an individual in almost like a tagged manner? I have very high proficiency in writing copy, perhaps as that VP of marketing. But instead of the VP of marketing, I focus on the fact that I'm good at copy, or I focus on the fact that I'm really good at storytelling, or that I'm a really great designer. And these particular skills themselves of doing the tasks, that's really what we focus on. So not having to fit within certain boxes on teams or within companies, but going, Erin's really good at this one thing and this 10 things. And that's how we're going to kind of move her around into different roles.
Absolutely. What do you think then? Because you mentioned before about that helping in terms of companies being able to work with different types of talent, like you mentioned independent contractors, you mentioned freelancers. What do you think then? How can about the skills-based approach and how it can support work innovation?
Yeah, I think we're going to see a lot more companies have internal talent pools. So basically, this is a list of kind of either trusted external contractors and freelancers that you maintain a relationship, whether or not you have a project for them or not, but also just cataloging all of those skills in a very data-backed manner that you currently have within your organization. So I think culturally, we're going to see this shift of, okay, how do I have really high engagement and employee satisfaction or worker satisfaction? And like, what is that employee experience like for both contractors and in-house employees? So I think that's going to be a major shift. But when we start looking at internal talent pools and having catalog skills and engaged and ready workers, we can move a lot more quickly and we can kick things off, which is such a massive part of basically having innovation, right? It's about speed and ability to move and adapt to new learnings. And Upwork had a really great report on innovator companies as well. So you can check out that in the Upwork Research Institute. But work innovator companies were 2.6 times more likely to know what work is better suited for freelancers. And it lends itself to knowing which skill sets are basically kind of this projectification, right? How do we do skills-based work? And then how does that basically lend itself more to freelancers?
Absolutely. I think there's so much to be learned. There's still so much around this area that I think is very new. And we know that we've seen firms in the past that have taken up skills-based approach and is they've reported their success on it. It's sort of taking a competency route, let's call it MasterCard being one of them, who they purported more than 200 million in productivity to take in a skills-based approach. So can you tell us a bit more? Because I know you continue to write in this area, and I know you have a weekly publication. Is it Weekly Workforce? Can you tell me a little bit more about that?
Yeah, absolutely. It's weeklyworkforce.com for anyone who wants to like and subscribe. And really, it's an outlet for me to talk about all of these random brain wormholes that I like to go down and thinking about what would happen in the world if we had this one change. The other thing is, I'm just an avid internet reader, so I like to do massive summaries of different things. I watched all of the Davos Growth and Jobs reports, and I summarized them, for example, from World Economic Forum. So I pick a topic and do a ton of research and share that in an easily digestible manner with everyone in their inbox every Sunday.
Awesome. Yeah, I've been enjoying reading it because it really keeps me up to date. And there's so much to keep up to date on. I mean, we know that one thing that
Sure.
is constant is pace, the pace of change that's just kept accelerating and kept accelerating. So I do really appreciate that
Yes.
copy.
Yeah, no shortage of things to write about, that's for sure.
Absolutely, absolutely. What do you think? And I'm going a little bit wider here. So we speak a lot about what companies can do. We speak about what individuals can do in terms of supporting new ways of working. What about wider society? So for example, what about governments and those who, let's say, govern employment regulations and these sort of areas? Where do you think they should be looking?
Absolutely. I think, when we talk about governance in general, it's always a bit of a big, hairy problem because as the workforce gets more and more distributed internationally, this also gets much more complex. So I think a lot of different companies are really trying to do a focus on employment classification and how this works because it's a fine balance between I want to have enough structure and rules and regulations in place that workers can't be taken advantage of. So, I have someone who maybe looks and smells like an employee, but I'm not going to give them health benefits. I'm not going to give them paid time off, all these things that really should be protected as workers' rights. But we also don't want to go all the way the other side of being too prescriptive, where we eliminate the ability for people to easily become self-employed and easily be a contractor or a freelancer. Things like, gosh, did I just tiptoe across a threshold and suddenly I have to pay into different dividends, or I'm in a different tax bracket, or all of a sudden I'm unable to make certain claims on, housing benefets or, childcare and so on and so forth. So I think a lot of different governments are trying to figure it out. We have IR35, that's a very hot topic here in the UK. There's the kind of new EU platform directive for platform and freelance workers that basically tiptoes around all different types of things with employment classification. Lots of hot debate on it. I continue to report on it regularly because it's such a changing landscape. But I think if we think about it in those two polarities of how do we create, enough structure that we support people to be independent, but also protect workers.
Yeah, exactly. And we often hear a lot about creating common language, and I know that's one of the issues that makes it quite difficult to navigate. So I do hope that that is something that we can get around in the future through that sort of collaboration between the freelancers, between wider society, and between organizations, because the world of work is marching forward. It's moving, things are changing, and I think we should be open to that. So yeah,
Yeah,
fingers crossed.
absolutely. Yeah, and it's such a personal thing too when you get into language. Like to some people, like gig is a dirty word, right? So we could go down so many avenues with this.
Even digital nomads. I found that out too in my own research that some people they don't like being called digital nomads. I'm fine with the term, but I know other people they don't like it.
Exactly. So it's tough when you're going, will we ever really have a unified language when, everyone's experiences are so unique? I don't really know.
Yeah, exactly. There's no one answer. We're not gonna get there overnight. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Erin. Thank you for joining us. Thank you for all of the knowledge that you shared with us. And we're going to continue reading your weekly workforce digestive because it is really a good, just condensed version of getting our heads around everything that's happening in the new world workspace as we speak. But just before we go, can you tell us a little something personal about yourself? So when you're not working, what would you say is your favorite thing to get into?
Yes, well, it's but maybe listeners don't know. I have a dog. He's sleeping next to me here. He's very lazy, but we mostly are getting out and exploring different parts of London, walking a lot. I also crochet and do lots of like old lady crafts, and I'm a real sucker for a really good like just reality TV binge. So
We're so opposite in that area. I am so like anti-reality TV. But I know
I
people, I
love
notice
it.
people love it. Yeah, absolutely. But then my weak point then is Lifetime movies. I know they're absolutely crap,
Oh,
but
I can't because I just, they're so predictable. At least with
yes.
reality TV, you're like, what just happened?
Yeah, exactly. Well, that's true, actually. Yeah. But anytime I don't feel like thinking, I put a Lifetime movie on. I'm like, I just want to zone out. Just put some Lifetime movie. And I think that's reality TV for a lot of people.
It's like good background noise. You don't really have to pay that much attention because it's not that important.
Exactly. Well, thank you so
Yeah.
much, Erin. Thank you for joining us. Thank you for everything that you shared with us. And where can our audiences find you if they wanted to reach out to you for the type of work that you do or anything interesting or speaking engagements? Where could they find
Absolutely. Feel free to find me on LinkedIn, or you can always drop an email. It's Erin, Eryn, at startupconsortium.io.
Awesome. Thank you so much. And thank you for our audiences for joining us for another episode of Remotely Speaking Up. We will see you next week. And of course, if you want to know more about a podcast, you can find us at Remotely Speaking Up on Instagram. And if you want to explore the world of work and how it can impact your company, or you want to know where to start on that journey, feel free to reach out onto LinkedIn, drrochellehaines.com, and we can have a chat. All right, take care, and hopefully we'll see you joining us next week again. Bye.
Thank you. Bye.
I hope you enjoyed our podcast series. To find out more, follow us at Remotely Speaking Up on Instagram or go to www.crowdpotential.co.uk for our services. Until next time. Welcome back to Remotely Speaking Up. We have another episode, and with every episode, you know, brings one of our brilliant experts in the area of remote work and future of work in general. And this week we have Lorraine Charles with us. And Lorraine Charles is where do I start, Lorraine? You're an absolutely amazing human being.
Oh, no.
With what you're doing, your mission is so unique. I love what you have created, and we're going to tell our audience a little bit more about that. So Lorraine is a social entrepreneur. She's also a digital solutions expert, and she's created an organization known as Namal. And what Namal does is help to bring forcibly displaced refugees together with remote work opportunities all over the globe. So Lorraine is effectively helping freelancers, creating freelancers, or bringing freelancers from the global south and connecting them with opportunities all over the world, which I think is absolutely fantastic. Okay, so Lorraine is here to talk to us today about leveraging refugee talent and how our evolving workforce and our evolving ways of working allows us to do that. So welcome, Lorraine. I'm so happy to have you here.
Thank you. It's so great to be here, to be in your company.
Oh,
I'm
thank
also a
you.
big fan of yours, so the love is going both ways.
Oh, thank you
So,
so much. So, can you tell us a bit about what inspired Namal? Because, as I said, it's quite a unique organization. Your mission itself is quite unique. So, what inspired that?
namal, and I want to talk a little bit about the meaning of the word. It's an Arabic word, namal. It means we work,
Namal.
but amal also means hope. So we hope we work. This is sort of beautiful play on words. And as you said, we link refugees to remote work. And I think it started when I was doing research. So I'm a researcher. Well, that's where I started, not as an entrepreneur. I always say I'm a reluctant entrepreneur. So I was doing research to understand the challenges the refugees face in the Middle East, in Jordan and Turkey, and then later Lebanon. And when I looked at the challenges, the big recommendation for, from that initial research was remote work for refugees. How can we reconceptualize employment because of the specific challenges the refugees faced in those particular countries where I was doing research? Lack of access to local employment, just not enough opportunities, and also an environment which wasn't friendly toward refugees. So remote work for refugees, reconceptualizing employment. And this research, led me to sort of, exploring beyond, what was happening beyond, beyond Jordan and Turkey to explore Lebanon. And this really captivated me that this could be a new way to look at work. But I have to add, this is before COVID. This was in 2017, 2016 when I was doing the research, writing about it in 2017. So really at a time when the world looked different to the way it looked now. And by proposing some, when I proposed remote work for refugees, I was really the first person to write an article for the World Economic Forum, Remote Work for Refugees, in 2017. And at that time, I had discussions and, starting to realize that I had to do something, not just do research. And the early discussions, people weren't really, they were interested, but weren't convinced that it could work. So I had comments like, yeah, interesting, very niche. It's not going to work, not scalable. Fast forward, COVID changed things, but fast forward to 2024, the whole space looks different. There's a lot of interest from loads of different organizations. Lots of funding is going toward that space. But really, I was inspired by how can we provide opportunity for people who didn't have opportunity where they are.
Yeah, and I mean, I could understand even at that stage, like 2017, because I mean, if it feels so still, the mission feels quite unique in 2024, I can imagine 2017, people thought you were crazy.
Literally, people thought I was crazy.
Yeah.
Literally, yes, they thought they did think I was crazy. Like, no way, this is not gonna work, not gonna work. But I kept saying, yeah, but I work remotely. Like, I was a single parent. I was doing, looking after my kids and working for organizations that weren't in the same place where I was. So I was working remotely, but I thought, yeah, it's possible, I can do it.
So how does it work then? How does the process work of linking refugees to work in a global space?
So we started with the training. So we and because so apart from doing research on refugee issues, I did research on education. And one thing which I found, another gap, was a lot of organizations weren't very explicit in the sort of human skills, soft skills, 21st century skills. And we know that's really important
for employers. Employers often say, so soft skills are really important, and employers often say, technical skills get you the job, soft skills make you keep the job. And many organizations weren't teaching these skills explicitly. It was sort of implicitly implied in the programs, but we recognize that the explicit instruction, and this is really important, to get refugees to be visible. So NAML started by doing the training. And for a long time, we focused on the training, the sort of, workshops, interactive workshops and mentoring. And our initial model was to try to get companies like anyone to hire our talent. And we did have some success with companies wanting to engage with our talent. And but it wasn't as easy as I initially expected. And it didn't seem scalable. To get one person hired was such a huge, huge burden on our team that I thought, okay, I had to have a new model. Fast forward 2023, I was in one of my remote work sort of mastermind meetings. And my challenge, and we were sort of talking about issues in our enterprises. And I said, well, I can't find a way to get my talent hired. And then someone said in the group said to me, he says, Lorraine, I won't hire your talent, but I'll outsource a project to you. And suddenly I thought, okay, I've been resisting this try, this agency model where we take projects and our talent deliver the work. I've been resisting that, but suddenly I realized, okay, I have to move toward this model because this is the most scalable way, and it means that we can find projects for many more of our talent. And the effort that it takes to get one project was a lot less than what it took to get one refugee hired. So that's what we moved to now. So for example, Rochelle, if you want a website built, instead of going to an agency or going to a freelancer in London, you'd come to us. We'd help you scope out what you want, and our refugee talents would deliver the work to you. So we're building this ecosystem where our talent, even though they're junior talent, our tech leads can support them to deliver the project to the client. And what it means is we have a continuous flow of talent coming through our agency. As they get trained, they get the experience. And after a year, they've worked on maybe three or four projects. They look much more attractive to employers because they've worked building a website for this European company or this British nonprofit. So now their portfolio looks more attractive. They're like, ah, oh, yes, this person definitely belongs on my team because they've worked on a team doing this. They've done this project, they built this website, they've done this design. So that's what we're doing now, really, really engaging companies to send projects to us.
Yeah, so two things come out there for me. One, the fact that you had to be the linchpin to bring them together. And then the other half of that is that it reminds me of that marketing ethos where people work with who they know, like, and trust. So it sounds like they were familiar with you, but they weren't familiar with this new talent that they couldn't see, they've never had any contact with, they've never worked with. So it's like they trust you, and you had to be that pin to bring it together before then. They got to see the quality of the work that then your talent produced.
Exactly, and that's exactly the case because we're the trusted entity. We work with a brilliant partner called Equal Reach, and they so they're working with us to source projects, for the refugee talent. And right now, the trust is with NAML and Equal Reach. So organizations see us; they sort of we're familiar to them. So this and they feel confident, so confident that our first client—I can't say who it is—but our first client, we built a website for him. He then signed up for two other projects, and then he came back yesterday and said, "Oh, I want my website translated into Spanish. Can you now do this? This other build." So the fact is that when employers or companies see the quality of the work, they keep coming back for more. But it's just that initial, just that initial stage, and that's what we are. We're that we're opening the doors for our talent.
I think there's something so important there about the role you play because it's an empowering role. where you're lending your trust in order to facilitate opportunities to people that wouldn't typically have it. And I think
Yes.
that's absolutely inspiring because we don't think about that. Most companies, because they want to do business on a trust basis, yes, we know that in terms of working remotely within certain regions, yes, there are certain blockades. But I imagine sometimes on the softer element, the non-tangible element, the trust is a major factor, and the mal acts as almost borrowed trust to facilitate those opportunities.
Yes, exactly. We are that trust. And also because we have our senior tech leads. The first meeting, we bring in our tech leads and and they see the quality and they understand the background of our tech leads. And I have to say, one of our tech leads is also one of our alumni who's a refugee. He graduated in 2020, so he has a few years' experience. When our clients see the tech leads, then they feel more reassured that we can produce the work. And now as we build your portfolio, in a way, our first client, for him, it probably more risky than it was for us. But we really showed that we can do it. So now when new clients come to us, we can say, yes, we've done this, we've done this. So it's much easier now.
So what is it? I shouldn't say, I think my question more is, where does the talent come from? Where do you, what, where's your main source of refugee talent? What countries do you target?
So I mean, literally, we would work anywhere. But right now, our two projects were Ethiopia and Kenya. So those are the two country-specific projects, Ethiopia and Kenya. We just finished cohort one in both countries. Cohort two in both countries, because the funding will continue, will start in a few months. We also work globally with MIT Emerging Talent. So that's a global cohort. And again, an amazing, amazing group of individuals, just really inspiring. In fact, working with one of those, well, not an alumni, one of the current learners on a different project with on an ILO project I'm working on, one of the talent from that MIT React, MIT Emerging Talent, is doing the data analysis for another project I'm working on. So that's a global cohort. We're also doing a research project. And this research is to understand the impact of mentoring and coaching on refugees finding remote work, freelancing work, and that's a randomized controlled trial. So, and that's a global cohort. Again, the talent is mostly focused in East Africa, but with refugees really from everywhere. So, I guess our big focus now is East Africa.
And do you intend to expand that in the future?
Yeah, I mean, we started in the Middle East, and that's where our heart will always lie in the Middle East. That's where we started. We would like to do more in the Middle East. We do work with Middle Eastern refugees on our global cohorts. But in terms of a country-specific program, we don't have any in the Middle East at the moment, but we would like to.
Yeah, and I mean, you highlighted a lot of the things that Namal is doing there. And I know you guys have a lot of success stories to share, particularly your project with the ILO, is that right?
Yeah, so in Kenya, we're working with ILO. Oh my goodness. Okay, so I'm going to talk about Susan. I hope she wouldn't mind me mentioning her. So on our first project, she was one of the developers. And she did an amazing job. So there were three developers, three refugee developers, two from Kenya, one from what two in Kenya, one in Ethiopia. And Susan was the only female on that team. And she was actually the two tech leads are also men. And so she was the only female, and she sort of spoke about how she felt. So, she wasn't treated any differently. She really felt valued, and she was hugely valued. I was actually invited to speak on a panel for this organization, a panel, this sort of global advocacy organization called Business Fights Poverty. And I thought, no, I'm not going to speak. I'm going to ask Susan to speak on behalf of NAMO. So she spoke on the panel yesterday in Nairobi, and she did an amazing job. So not only did she do a great job as a de you know as a dev, she's doing a fantastic job advocating for our advocating for other refugees and talking about the work and the project, which sort of helped her. So that's an amazing success story. And another amazing story is, as I said, one of our tech leads is one of our alumni from our first program with MIT in 2020. He was an Eritrean refugee living in Ethiopia. Instantly recognized as brilliant, like brilliant. And I always said, if I get no one a job, I'm getting him a job. So I did get him a job initially, with someone from our remote work community. And then when we started a project in Ethiopia just about a year ago, I finally brought him on board. I'm like, okay, now I really want you to work with us. So he coordinated our Ethiopia program. And then when we started the agency, he became a tech lead. So really, he could have moved up and now he's guiding other refugees, into being better and more and more visible.
Yeah, that's really inspiring. I know from working with you firsthand, being a mentor as well to some of the refugees, to one of the refugees in Kenya, I can testify, and I mean, I'm blown away by just how brilliant the refugee talent is there. I'm mentoring an undergraduate, and just when I'm speaking with him, I'm really, really blown away by how much he knows, how much he's done. But for me also, it's the passion and where the passion comes from. So I do believe that you've tapped into this really unthought of, let's say before, mainstream unthought of source of talent that has so much to give to the world, and all they needed was open access. All they needed was a door.
Yeah, I mean, Rochelle, that makes me feel so happy, almost cry, because we still believe in our talent. We know they're brilliant. But when someone from the outside tells us this, we're like, okay, we're on the right path. We're doing the right thing. Because for us, we see it all the time. And sometimes we think we take it for granted, but just hearing it from the outside, I feel inspired that we have to, we continue, we forge on, despite sometimes all the challenges.
No, my mind is still blown. I really enjoy my conversations with him because just his knowledge is really just mind-blowing sometimes. So you just touched on the challenges that you face when you're dealing with this. Can you tell me a bit more about how hiring refugee talent, especially in areas that are seemingly restricting for hiring, how does that challenge traditional recruitment practices? So for example, let's say a company in the UK is trying to hire refugee talent remotely. What are some of the challenges that you've seen to that traditional process?
We spoke about trust, and so much of it is lack of trust, lack of really knowing the talent, because unfortunately, the media has portrayed this image of refugees as people needing help, of people not being worthy. So when we say the word refugee, no one thinks of someone really, really intelligent, really tech savvy, someone who's ambitious and amazing. That parallel doesn't exist very easily. So often we have to just break down those preconceptions. So I think that's often the biggest barrier, the preconceptions. Often convincing HR, and HR, I guess, are very, very risk averse. They're hiring someone who, A, they can't get recommendations for, and B, if they get recommendations, maybe those recommendations also need recommendations, because those recommendations are still, unknown to them. So in terms of traditional hiring, there are huge obstacles, because of this mainly lack of trust and just lack of understanding. But also, also there's this sort of perception that this person won't be living in a place where they can work. They wouldn't have connectivity. They wouldn't have a device. So we have to really explain to potential employers what the talent can do and what they're able to do. I remember I was at home, I was in Cambridge a few months ago. And talking about NAML, and we had one of our refugee talent zoom in, and they were just blown away by how incredible he. I'm often surprised that people are surprised at how amazing the talent are, because for us it's just this is what we're used to, but sometimes they have to look at it through other people's eyes and just think they haven't had it, and they haven't had the experience we have working with the talent we have, and just recognizing just how incredible they are. But for us, and one thing I keep saying is, there is nothing that separates us from a refugee apart from this, apart from this label, this status. And it's only because of an accident of birth that they're in this situation. This can happen to any of us any day. And I really always like to bring this to everyone's attention. Anyone can become a refugee.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, like when you read the news and you hear like these like fears of World War III or these fears of war that's been creeping up everywhere now, it even
Yes.
becomes more salient. It becomes more poignant, the fact
Yes.
that can happen at any time.
Yes. And of course, there's climate refugees. Climate change is fast approaching. And Mia Motley, who's I'm a big fan of, the what's it called? The Bridgetown,
Yeah, so Bridgetown
yes.
initiative. Let me double.
Yes, yes.
Go ahead.
Yeah. Yes. Around how the countries that are contributing the least to climate change are the ones they're going to be affected the affected first and the most. So there's this sort of disparity with the global north countries thinking that they're immune. They think by sealing their borders they can become immune, but really they're the ones that are perpetrating perpetrating the damage which is done to often cause displacement. And this is not just climate change, this is political as well. So many of the refugee crisis have been caused by as a result of call of the legacy of colonization, of a legacy of this perceived supremacy of the global north countries.
Yeah, and that's not even being political. That's fact. That's history. That's history. So,
It is history.
yeah. So it's a real shame that a lot of the way that we envision refugees and the assumptions that and the stereotypes that people have that are based on incorrect narratives and political narratives and historical narratives and media narratives, they're just not true. So it's really good
Exactly.
for organizations like yours who put that spotlight and that reality on what it is to be a refugee and put a positive face to refugees as well.
Yeah, and in our podcast, we're sharing the stories of refugees, talking about how they're linked to the future of work, and really sharing their experiences and their perceptions of what. Of how they can be integrated into the work of the future.
Well, it's just really inspiring to hear. I love what you're doing, and I really hope you continue to do it. And I love these success stories as well that you're sharing.
We'll
So,
have a lot more success stories to come. We're just excited by it.
oh, that's so good. So, what would you say is the future for Namal? What's the next big thing that you're working on?
Yeah, I guess the agency, that's new. We literally started in January. So very, very new. We want to really scale the agency. We need to get more capacity within the organization to do more. We only have, well, one tech lead is part-time, one's full-time. Well, kind of two part-time in a way. We need more tech leads. We need more capacity within the organization to do more. So really working on the agency. We'd like to sort of work in other countries beyond East Africa, but we know that will come with time. But really focusing on just highlighting this amazing talent, showing what they can do to the world, and really changing the narrative for companies. Because I said earlier that there's so much investment and discussion around it, about digital economy for refugees. There's a lot of funding. The UN and lots of foundations are funding it, and there's lots of sort of lots of work around it. But what the missing piece is the private sector. The private sector hasn't quite caught up with what's happening within the sort of development, not, you know, development funding space. And for me, that's the next step. How can we really mobilize the private sector to really engage with hiring refugees? And even if this looks like hiring, working with them initially through an agency model, getting familiar with the talent, and in a way, our agency model de-risks it for companies because we're the trust agent, so then the talent can have visibility. And then hopefully this will encourage companies to really recognize the talent.
Oh wow, that's amazing. Yeah, I'll really look out for what you've been doing because, as I said, it's just a completely inspiring story, and I love the fact that how you are turning around incorrect narratives, or kind of erasing incorrect narratives and rewriting those from the perspective of
Yeah.
people themselves. So I look forward to seeing more of that. Lorraine, just before we wrap up, can you tell us something about yourself? Because clearly, from everything you do, you're a very busy human being. You have so much on your plate, but what do you do in order to wind down? What keeps you sane in this entire process? What do you do in your
Oh
spirit?
my gosh. You know, that's a really tough question because now I don't feel the world is sane. No, I feel the world is it's quite absolutely insane. What do I do? Yeah, what do I do for sanity? I go to the gym and I do yoga.
Oh,
And
nice.
that's where I sort of begin to center myself. Unfortunately, my yoga teachers also feel the sense of urgency around the distressing situation happening in the world. So we sort of, we do yoga to sort of help us do more and advocate for a more equal world.
If you have so much of negative things coming through the media, sometimes I find yoga as a process of almost purging that out and giving you a center to go again.
Yes, indeed. It helps me go again because we have to keep, we have to keep fighting the fight.
And it
Because
is
the
having an
world.
impact. It is having an impact. Whether small, that impact is growing, and that impact matters.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, leaders need to start listening to people. Listen, and I say listen to young people. I feel so inspired by so many young people. I feel that they are the ones that are going to change the world. I'm not sure if our generation has been able to do it. Actually, we haven't. But I really feel, Gen Z, they are going to change the world. They really are. They don't take any nonsense. They call injustice out, and they aren't afraid of putting themselves on the line. And I say bravo to that. I really am inspired by that.
Yeah, I have to say the same because I have a niece, I have an 18-year-old niece, and she's been inspiring me so much lately, like so many times. Like we have these kind of back and forths, and when she pushes back on certain things, I stop and I'm like, I'm the adult. She's pushing back on me. I should have a problem because I'm her aunt. But she makes a good point, and she's absolutely right. And I'm really proud of her.
It's inspiring. It's amazing. And
Absolutely. Well, thank you
yeah.
so much. Thank you, Lorraine, for joining us. Thank you for everything you shared about Namal. Or I always say that wrong. Can you pronounce it again for us?
So you say correctly, the Arabic way is na'amal, but it's not, it doesn't roll easily unless you speak Arabic. Na'amal is fine.
Namo. Okay, good. Once I'm not completely butchering it.
No, so.
But thank you so much. Thank you for sharing your vision with us. Thank you for sharing all of the amazing stuff that you're doing, because as I said, I can only use the word inspiring. The whole thing is absolutely inspiring. So just before we go, where can our audiences find you if they wanted to reach out to you?
Find us on LinkedIn. We have we're very active on LinkedIn. Follow me on LinkedIn, or we've got a contact page on our website. Just send us a message. We're always looking for mentors. Like Rochelle does, we want more people to mentor, to really work with this inspiring talent. Because again, this demystifies what it means to be a refugee by having regular people who don't work in the refugee space, mentor refugees. Then you take the message, to your team, to your employer, to your HR, because you have personal experience with this talent.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. That's a good point, actually. All right, thank you so much, Lorraine. Thank you to our audiences for joining us for another week. And as you know, remotely speaking is the home to of future work trends, where we talk about how the world of work, our expectations and our approaches to work are changing, and what implications that has for organizations, the people that work with them, and the people that work in them. So if you want to know more about changing work trends and what you need to do to get the best out of your people and talent, please feel free to reach out at remotely speaking up or crowdpotential.co.uk. Thank you so much for joining us again, Lorraine. Thank you. And we will see you next week. Bye.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye. I hope you enjoyed our podcast series. To find out more, follow us at Remotely Speaking Up on Instagram or go to www.crowdpotential.co.uk for our services. Until next time.